Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details. Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to the deep dive. All right, today we're diving into something that might sound a little, well, standard perhaps, but trust me, it's anything but dry. We're talking about ISO 9001.2015.
That's right. Yeah, we've been digging into this comprehensive guide on it. And honestly, it's really shown that this standard is way more than just some certification badge you hang on the wall.
Okay.
So our mission today really is to unpack what makes it tick. You know, what does the requirements actually look like when they're put into practice? And maybe most importantly, the seriously powerful benefits it can unlock for an organization.
Right. Think of this as your absolute shortcut to getting genuinely well-informed about ISO 9001.
Yeah.
You know, without wading through those dense manuals or getting lost in a sea of acronyms, though, fair warning, we'll probably meet a few friendly ones along the way.
Yes, a few.
But the source material makes it crystal clear. This isn't just about formal compliance, right? It's not just ticking boxes.
Not at all. No, the guide frames it less as a hoop you had to jump through and more as a real, tangible competitive advantage. It's actually a powerful tool for transforming how an organization operates. And that can lead to, well, surprising efficiencies. And it can open doors to new business opportunities, too.
Right.
Especially through things like strategic partnerships.
Okay, let's pull back the curtain then. What exactly is this ISO 9001.2015? Let's start with the absolute foundation.
Okay, so at its heart, ISO 9001.2015 is an international standard. It's for something called a quality management system. You'll hear that shortened a lot to QMS.
QMS, right.
Yeah. And the core idea, it's actually beautifully simple.
Yeah.
Help organizations consistently deliver products and services that meet customer requirements. And by doing that, well, you boost customer satisfaction.
Got it. So it's kind of like a globally recognized recipe book, maybe, but for ensuring quality in whatever you do.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. Mm-hmm. It provides a framework for managing your organization's processes effectively. And a really key point the source stresses is its incredible flexibility.
Awesome.
Well, it's designed to be applicable to any organization. Doesn't matter the size, the type, or the products and services it provides. You know, a huge multinational corporation or a small local shop, they could both use it.
Wow, so it's not just for manufacturers turning out widgets then, like a hospital, a software company, maybe even a nonprofit could use this.
Precisely, yes. It's all about managing processes.
Yeah.
And every single organization has processes, right? This just gives you a structure to make sure those processes are reliable and effective.
Okay. That universality is really interesting. Now, the source dives deep into the different sections of the standard. They call them clauses, right?
That's right. Clauses.
Let's jump into clause 4, which is all about the context of the organization. This sounds like, well, figuring out where you sit in the world.
It is, yeah. And this is where the 2015 revision really upped its game, you could say. It's about genuinely understanding the environment your organization operates in, both internally and externally.
Okay, so understanding the organization itself first, what does the standard actually mean by that?
Well, the source explains you need to identify the internal factors and the external factors that are relevant to your strategic objectives. You know, your overall direction.
Your kernel factors, like?
Things like your company culture, the knowledge your people hold, your resources, your values, basically what makes your organization pick from the inside.
Okay.
And externally, well, you look outward.
Like the market, the economy, things like that.
Absolutely. The source specifically calls out analyzing the market.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking at your competition, broader social trends, any technological advancements that are relevant to your field.
Mm.
And of course, the legal and regulatory environment you have to navigate.
Right.
It's a really holistic view, trying to understand everything that could possibly impact your ability to achieve your quality goals.
So you're mapping out the landscape you're operating in. That makes sense. And then you look at interested parties. Who are they?
Yes, this is a crucial part of understanding the context. You need to identify all the relevant stakeholders. So the people or groups who have an interest in or are affected by your organization's performance.
Okay.
And then you need to figure out what their needs and expectations are, specifically regarding your quality management system.
So this is way broader than just your direct customers then.
Oh, much broader. Yeah. The source gives examples like customers, obviously. But also think about your suppliers, your employees, shareholders, or owners, and the various regulatory authorities you deal with.
Right. The government bodies and such.
Exactly. Each of these groups has certain requirements or expectations, and those can definitely influence your quality system.
Okay, so you understand your internal setup, the external world around you, and everyone who cares about what you do. Then you figure out the scope of the QMS. Is that the flow?
That's the logical next step, yeah. Based on all that understanding your context, the requirements of your interested parties, you then clearly define the boundaries and the applicability of your quality management system.
Meaning?
Well, what parts of your organization are actually included? Which specific products or services does this QMS cover? And this needs to be documented, made clear.
Okay. Can we get a real-world example? Did the source have one that brings this Clause 4 to life a bit?
Yeah, the source provides a pretty good one. Think about a manufacturing company.
Okay.
To tackle Clause 4, they might use something like a SWOT analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats.
Right, standard tool.
Exactly. Huh. To identify internal factors, like maybe they have a really skilled workforce, strength, or some aging equipment, weakness. And external factors like perhaps there's a new competitor entering the market, threat, or an opportunity to use more sustainable materials, opportunity.
Makes sense.
Then they'd map their stakeholders. Maybe local residents are concerned about noise levels, an interested party need. Employees definitely care about workplace safety. Another need. Customers might be demanding specific product certifications, a key requirement.
So you're tying those broader internal and external factors directly to what specific groups need or expect.
Precisely. And based on all of that input, they would then document the scope of their QMS. Maybe initially it only covers certain production lines that have had quality issues in the past, or perhaps it focuses just on product families aimed at a particularly quality-sensitive market segment.
And the benefit of doing all this work up front, the systematic approach, what does the source say?
Well, it fundamentally helps the company understand why quality is important in their specific situation and how external pressures or their own internal capabilities actually influence that. The source really emphasizes this, gives them a much better ability to adapt to market changes, adapt to stakeholder expectations, and do it proactively. You know,
yeah.
Rather than getting caught off guard.
That makes total sense. It's like getting your bearings before you start building anything significant. All right. So from setting the stage with context, we move to Clause 5, leadership. This seems pretty straightforward. You need leadership buy-in for quality.
It really does. Yeah, this clause is absolutely critical because it puts the responsibility for the QMS's effectiveness firmly at the top.
Mm.
It's not something you can just, you know, delegate to the quality manager and forget about. Top management has to be actively involved, demonstrably involved.
So leadership and commitment is the key phrase here.
Precisely. Top management must demonstrate direct responsibility and accountability for the QMS. The standard uses pretty strong language here. They need to show they are leading the QMS, not just sort of supporting it from a distance.
And part of that is creating a quality policy.
Yes. That policy is basically top management's formal statement, their commitment to quality. It needs to be consistent with the organization's context that we just talked about and its overall strategic direction.
Making it clear how quality fits into the big picture.
Exactly. Showing how it supports the business goals.
Mm.
And crucially, it has to be communicated effectively and, importantly, understood throughout the entire organization, not just posted on a wall somewhere.
Everyone needs to know the quality mission, basically.
And Clause 5 also requires clearly defining organizational roles, responsibilities, and authorities related to the QMS.
So who does what?
Yeah. Who is responsible for what aspect of quality? Who has the authority to make decisions, maybe stop a production line if there's an issue? This needs to be crystal clear to avoid confusion and ensure everyone's accountable.
Did the source give a practical example showing that top-level involvement in action?
It did. Imagine a service company. The CEO might show commitment by say, regularly chairing the quality steering committee meetings.
Okay, being present.
Right. They'd personally sign off on the quality policy, making sure it truly reflects the company's mission, maybe that's providing exceptional customer service, quickly and reliably.
Yeah.
And, critically, they'd ensure that the necessary resources are actually allocated.
Like budget, staff.
Exactly. Like hiring enough skilled staff, or maybe investing in better technology to improve service delivery, making sure the means are there to achieve the quality goals.
So it's really not just a signature on a document. It's active participation and making sure the resources follow the commitment.
Right. The source highlights that this kind of direct, visible involvement from the very top management is absolutely fundamental. It's what helps embed a genuine quality culture that then flows down through every level of the organization. It really sets the tone.
That really underscores that it's a strategic initiative, isn't it? Not just an operational chore. Okay, we've set the context, we've got leadership on board. Now it's time for clause 6, planning. This sounds like where proactive thinking really comes in.
It is, absolutely. And this is where that concept of risk-based thinking, which was a big focus of the 2015 update, really comes into play strongly. Clause 6 is all about planning what you're actually going to do within your QMS.
Starting with addressing risks and opportunities.
Correct. Organizations have to adopt a risk-based approach to their planning. What that means is systematically identifying potential threats, things that could derail your quality goals.
Like what kind of threats?
Oh, anything that could cause nonconformities, maybe delay deliveries, harm customer satisfaction. But it's not just negative. You also identify opportunities.
The positive side.
Exactly. Things that could help you improve your QMS, maybe enhance customer satisfaction even further, or achieve your objectives more effectively or efficiently.
So it's not just about avoiding problems, but actively looking for ways to get better, too.
Exactly. It involves a systematic analysis of both sides of that coin. You're essentially thinking ahead. What could go wrong here? What could go right? And how does knowing that inform the plans we make?
And based on that risk and opportunity analysis, you set quality objectives.
Yes. You need to establish measurable quality objectives. And these aren't just plucked out of thin air. They need to be consistent with your quality policy and relevant to different parts of the organization.
Relevant how?
Relevant to different functions, different levels, maybe specific key processes. And these aren't set and forget it targets either. They need to be monitored, tracked, and updated as needed.
So concrete, measurable goals that stem directly from your thinking about risks and opportunities.
Precisely. They provide clear targets for what your QMS is actually trying to achieve. And finally, Clause 6 also covers the planning of changes. It requires that any significant changes you make to your QMS or your processes are planned and managed in a controlled way.
Why is that important?
To avoid unintended negative consequences. You don't want to change in one area to accidentally break something else.
Let's get a practical example for planning. Did the source offer one?
Yeah, the source uses a food company again. Let's say they identify a risk of bacterial contamination in one of their production lines.
Okay, serious risk.
Definitely. An opportunity might be a new type of packaging technology that could significantly extend the product's shelf life.
Right.
So based on this thinking, a quality objective might be something specific like reduce customer complaints related to spoilage by 20% within the next 12 months.
Measurable, time-bound.
Exactly. And it links directly to managing that key contamination risk and potentially leveraging the packaging opportunity. They then plan specific actions to achieve this objective. Maybe implementing stricter hygiene protocols in that production area, or piloting the new packaging technology on a small scale first.
This sounds like it really forces you to be strategic about quality, doesn't it? Not just tactical day-to-day stuff.
It really does. As the source notes, this kind of structured planning, informed by a clear view of risks and opportunities, fundamentally shifts your approach. You move from just reacting to problems after they happen to proactively preventing them and also actively seizing opportunities for improvement.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, moving on to Clause 7, which is all about support. This feels like the backbone, right? Providing everything you need to actually make the plan happen.
Right. Yep. Backbone is a good word. This clause focuses on ensuring the organization determines and provides the necessary, everything needed, really. Resources, competence, awareness, communication, and the documented information required to establish, implement, maintain, and continually improve the QMS.
Let's break that down. Resources first. What does that cover? Is it just money?
Oh, no. It's quite broad. You need to determine and provide the necessary resources, yes. This includes the obvious, like people having enough staff with the right skills, but also infrastructure.
Infrastructure.
Yeah, buildings, utilities, equipment, hardware, software, transportation, whatever physical things you need, and also the environment for the operation of processes.
What does that mean, the environment?
It covers both physical factors like temperature, humidity, light, space, and social or psychological factors. Think about creating a non-discriminatory, calm, non-confrontational work environment where people can focus and do quality work.
Okay, so the physical stuff and the human factors. Interesting. And then competence.
Absolutely vital. Anyone whose work affects the performance and effectiveness of your QMS must be competent to do that work.
Competent based on?
Based on appropriate education, training, or experience. And the organization needs to take actions to ensure competence, like providing training, and keep records of that competence. Evidence that people are qualified.
So you need to make sure people can actually do the job right and prove it.
Exactly. And equally important is awareness. It's not enough for people to be competent. They also need to be aware.
Aware of what?
Aware of the quality policy, aware of the quality objectives that are relevant to their specific work, aware of how their contribution actually impacts the QMS and helps achieve those quality goals. And importantly, aware of the implications of not conforming to requirements. What happens if things go wrong because they didn't follow the process?
So everyone needs to understand their piece of the quality puzzle.
That's a great way to put it, yes.
Communication is in there, too.
Yes. Clause 7 requires determining the necessary internal and external communications relevant to the QMS.
Meaning what, specifically?
Thinking about who needs to know what. When do they need to know it? What channels should you use? Email, meetings, notices. And who are you communicating with? For instance, communicating new quality objectives to all employees, or maybe communicating changes in product specifications to your key suppliers.
Okay, planning your comms. And finally, documented information. This is often the part people associate most with ISO, maybe dread a little.
Right, the stereotype of mountains of binders and procedures. But the 2015 version was actually a significant shift here.
How so?
It's much less prescriptive about what specific documents must be created compared to earlier versions of the standard.
Really?
Yes. You must maintain the documented information that the standard explicitly requires. But beyond that, the organization needs to determine any additional documentation that it considers necessary for its QMS to be effective.
So it's more about what adds value to your specific organization, not just creating documents for the sake of having them.
Precisely. The source really emphasizes this flexibility. Factors like the size of your organization, the complexity of your processes, and even the competence of your people will influence how much documentation you actually need. A small team of highly experienced experts might need less detailed written procedures than a large operation with lots of new hires.
Give us the practical example for Clause 7 again. How does this all come together?
Okay, the source paints a picture of an engineering company. For resources, they might invest in state-of-the-art CAD software and specialized lab equipment and ensure their office and workshop facilities are well-maintained and suitable.
Right, the tools in place.
For competence and training, they could implement a system for tracking engineers' qualifications and professional certifications and provide ongoing professional development, maybe training on new material science or project management methodologies.
Keeping skills sharp.
Exactly. For awareness, maybe they hold regular all-hands meetings to discuss quality performance metrics and upcoming project quality goals, and use internal newsletters to highlight quality successes.
Getting the message out.
Communication might be handled through standardized project management platforms for team collaboration and clear reporting lines for escalating issues. And for documented information, maybe they've moved away from paper and adopted a digital document management system, an intranet perhaps, for managing engineering drawings, test procedures, project plans, and meeting records.
That really shows how these different support elements, resources, skills, awareness, communication, information, all weave together to enable quality work.
It's really about providing the right tools, the right skills, the right information, and the right environment so people can do quality work effectively.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly for Clause 8, operation. This feels like the core, the place where the actual product or service gets designed, produced, and delivered.
It absolutely is, yeah. Clause 8 covers the whole spectrum of activities involved in delivering value to the customer, from understanding their needs right through to producing and releasing the final output.
It starts with operational planning and control. What's that?
This is where you take your high-level plans from Clause 6 and translate them into day-to-day operational reality. It's about planning, implementing, and controlling the specific processes needed to meet the requirements for your products and services.
Like defining the steps.
Yes, and defining the criteria for how those processes will operate. How will you know if the process is running correctly? And how will you determine if the final product or service is acceptable? Setting those controls up front.
Then the next big chunk is about understanding the requirements for products and services.
Right, and this is broken down further. First subsection is customer communication, establishing effective ways to talk to your customers.
About what?
All sorts of things. Providing information about your products or services, handling inquiries, managing orders or contracts, getting feedback, both positive and negative, dealing with complaints effectively, and even having contingency plans for unexpected issues.
The example the source used here was an online customer portal, right?
Yeah, that's a great modern illustration from the source. An online portal can cover many of those bases efficiently. Customers place orders, that's handling orders contracts. They find product specs, information, track their order status, inquiries, submit feedback forms, and log complaints if needed. It can really streamline multiple communication needs.
Makes sense. Okay, next under requirements is determining requirements. Sounds obvious, but what does it entail?
It means you need a process to make sure all the relevant requirements are clearly defined and understood before you start work.
All requirements? Like
requirements specify by the customer what they explicitly asked for, but also requirements that might be implied but not stated, like basic safety expectations or usability. Then there are legal and regulatory requirements, industry standards, laws you have to comply with, and finally, any requirements the organization itself defines for quality or performance.
Okay, pulling it all together. The source mentioned a structured system for this.
Yes. Ideally, you'd have a systematic way to capture requirements from these different sources, maybe checklists, databases, review meetings, combining customer specifications with legal databases and your own internal quality manuals, for instance. The goal is to ensure nothing critical gets missed before you agree to deliver.
And crucially, before you say yes to an order, you must review requirements.
Yes, absolutely crucial step. Before you commit to providing a product or service, you must review all the requirements you've determined. First, to ensure you fully understand them, and second, critically, to confirm that your organization actually has the capability, the resources, the skills, the time to meet them.
So preventing that classic mistake of overpromising and underdelivering.
Exactly that. And the results of this review, plus any changes to requirements that come up, need to be kept as documented information, evidence that you did the check.
The source example was a formal order acceptance process.
Right. Like a checklist or workflow that includes specific checks on production capacity, logistics feasibility, maybe even financial terms, before an order confirmation is sent to the customer.
What if you design the products or services yourself? Does the standard cover that?
It does. That's covered in Clause 8.3, Design and Development. If design and development is part of what your organization does, you must establish, implement, and maintain a process for it.
A process with specific stages?
Typically, yes. The process needs planning. What are the key stages or phases? It needs defined inputs. What information do you need to start the design? Market needs, technical specs, regulations. It needs controls. How will you review, verify, and validate the design at different points? It needs defined outputs. What documents or prototypes are produced at each stage? And importantly, it needs a way to manage any design changes that occur.
The appliance company example from the source illustrated this phased process, didn't it?
Yes, perfectly. They might use a staged approach, maybe concept development, then detailed engineering design, then building prototypes, then rigorous testing. At planned points between these stages, they hold formal design reviews. Those are the controls involving experts from different areas, engineering, manufacturing, marketing, safety, to catch potential issues early.
And the inputs drive the process.
Right. Inputs could include market trend analysis, feedback from previous models, new safety standards, material constraints, and so on. And they'd test prototypes thoroughly against requirements before the final design gets approved for production.
Okay, moving on. Clause 8.4 is about controlling externally provided processes, products, and services. That sounds like managing your suppliers and subcontractors.
Spot on. Yeah, basically anything you get from outside your organization, whether it's a physical component, a raw material, a subcontracted process, or even a service like calibration that affects your ability to deliver quality to your own customers, needs to be controlled.
How do you decide how much control is needed? You can't treat every supplier the same, surely.
No, exactly. The standard requires you to determine the type and extent of controls based on the potential impact of what the external provider gives you. You wouldn't apply the same level of scrutiny to the company that supplies your office stationery as you would to the one providing critical safety components for your product.
Right. So, how does an organization figure out that right level of control in practice?
The source's example of an automotive company is helpful here. They might classify their suppliers based on the criticality of the part they supply an engine control unit versus, say, floor mats.
Big difference.
Huge. For strategic suppliers providing critical components, they might conduct periodic audits of the supplier's own quality management system. For less critical suppliers, maybe they just require incoming inspection of goods based on a statistical sampling plan. They would also provide all suppliers with very detailed technical specifications and quality requirements to ensure everyone knows exactly what's needed.
So this isn't just about checking stuff when it arrives at your door. It's much more about managing the supplier relationship proactively to prevent problems upstream.
Precisely. As the source highlights, the goal is to prevent defects or issues before the externally provided items even reach your own production line or service delivery process. It's about ensuring quality throughout the supply chain.
Got it. Clause 8.5 is production and service provision. This is the actual making or doing part, right?
This is it. This is about carrying out your planned operational processes under controlled conditions to actually create the product or deliver the service.
What do controlled conditions mean here?
It means ensuring several things are in place, like having the necessary documented information available where needed think work instructions, recipes, standard operating procedures, making sure any monitoring and measuring equipment used is suitable and calibrated, ensuring the infrastructure and work environment are appropriate, having competent personnel performing the tasks, taking steps to prevent human error where possible. And it also covers things like the release of the product service, delivery activities, and even post-delivery activities like installation, warranty, or support.
The luxury hotel example the source used really brings controlled conditions to life for a service.
It does, doesn't it? Think about their detailed procedures for every guest interaction. Check-in, room cleaning standards, how a meal is served in the restaurant. They likely have systems to identify repeat guests and remember their preferences. They have procedures to ensure guests' belongings are secure. Maintenance checks on rooms and facilities are proactive, not just reactive. And post-delivery, they might have a structured program for gathering feedback after checkout or efficiently handling lost and found items. Every step is managed to ensure a consistent, high-quality guest experience.
That makes sense. Okay, next is Clause 8.6, Release of Products and Services. This sounds like the final quality date before it goes to the customer.
It is exactly that. You have to implement plan arrangements, checks, tests, inspections, reviews at appropriate stages to verify that the product or service requirements have actually been met before you release it to the customer.
And you generally can't release it unless those checks are successfully completed.
That's the rule. Release should not proceed until all the planned arrangements have been satisfactorily completed. The only exception is if it's specifically approved by relevant authority, and sometimes, if applicable, by the customer themselves.
The source gave the pharmaceutical company example here, which felt very high stakes.
Extremely high stakes, yes. Every single batch of medication they produce goes through rigorous, documented laboratory analysis against predefined specifications. The batch absolutely cannot be released for distribution until a designated, qualified, quality-responsible person reviews all the test data and documentation and formally approves the release, confirming it meets all critical safety and efficacy parameters.
You can see why that final check is absolutely non-negotiable in that industry.
Exactly. It's the final safeguard preventing potentially unsafe or ineffective products from reaching patients.
Okay, so what happens when, despite all these plans and controls, something still goes wrong? That's Clause 8.7, Control of Nonconforming Outputs.
It happens. No system is perfect. This clause requires you to identify any outputs, products, or services that do not conform to requirements, and then control them to prevent their unintended use or delivery.
Control them how?
First step is usually segregation, physically separating the bad stuff from the good stuff if possible. Then identification, clearly labeling it so it doesn't get mixed up.
Okay, quarantine it. And then you take action.
Yes, you need to take appropriate action based on the nature of the nonconformity and its effect. Actions can include correcting the issue, rework, segregating it permanently, containing it, returning it to a supplier, suspending service, informing the customer, or maybe getting authorization from the customer or internally to accept it under concession if it's still usable for a different purpose or the deviation is minor.
The food company example seemed to clarify this well.
It did. If they find non-conforming products, let's use the example of yogurt tubs with the wrong expiration date printed on the label, they immediately segregate that batch. The source mentions using something like bright red labels for clear visual identification. After evaluation, they decide the action. Maybe they can simply relabel the batch correctly. That's a correction. Or if the product itself was compromised, perhaps it has to be downgraded for animal feed, acceptance under concession for alternative use, or maybe destroyed entirely. The key is it doesn't get shipped to a supermarket shelf as a conforming product.
And documenting all of this, the problem, the decision, the action is key for later analysis, right?
Absolutely. The source emphasizes that records must be kept of the nonconformity, the actions taken, any concessions obtained, and who authorized the action. This documentation is vital input for performance evaluation, Clause 9, and for identifying trends that might point to underlying problems needing corrective action, Clause 10. You look for patterns and nonconformities to find the root causes.
Okay, so Clause 8 is really where the operational rubber meets the road, focusing on consistently delivering what you promised. But how do you actually know if this whole system, Clauses 4 through 8, is working effectively? That sounds like the job of Clause 9, performance evaluation.
Exactly. You got it. Clause 9 is all about checking the performance and the effectiveness of your QMS. It starts logically with monitoring, measurement, analysis, and evaluation.
What does that involve in practice? What are you monitoring?
Well, the organization first needs to figure out what actually needs to be monitored and measured to give meaningful insight into the performance of its QMS and its processes. You then need to determine the methods you'll use for monitoring and measurement to ensure you get reliable, valid data. You need to decide when you're going to do the monitoring and measuring continuously, daily, weekly, per batch. And finally, when you'll analyze and evaluate the results you've collected.
So it's a systematic approach to gathering and using data.
Very much so. The source stresses that actively evaluating the QMS performance and its overall effectiveness is fundamental to the standard. It's not just about collecting data. It's about understanding what it tells you.
What kinds of things are typical to monitor and measure?
The source lists several common examples. Things like customer satisfaction, maybe through surveys, feedback forms, analyzing complaints data, process performance using key performance indicators, KPIs for your core processes, like production yield, on-time delivery rates, error rates in service transactions. Product or service conformity itself results from inspections, tests, defect rates, and maybe supplier performance tracking their on-time delivery, the quality of goods received.
And you analyze these results periodically to see trends and patterns.
Precisely. You don't just let the data sit there. The source suggests analysis is typically done at planned intervals, maybe monthly, for operational KPIs, quarterly for customer satisfaction trends, specifically to identify how you're doing, spot negative trends early, and find opportunities for improvement.
The IT service company example we touched on earlier seems to fit perfectly here.
It does. They monitor operational KPIs, like the average time it takes to resolve customer technical support incidents, system availability or uptime, maybe the number of recurring problems reported. They also actively measure user satisfaction, perhaps through post-incident surveys. This data is then analyzed formally, say, monthly. If they see that average incident resolution times are creeping up, that's a clear signal that something in their support process needs investigation and potential improvement.
Makes sense. Clause 9 also includes internal audits. What role do they play?
A really critical one. You must conduct internal audits at planned intervals. These audits serve a few key purposes. They check if your QMS conforms to your own established requirements, like are people actually following your documented procedures and policies. They also check if it conforms to the requirements of the ISO 9001 standard itself. And very importantly, they assess if the system is effectively implemented and maintained in practice. Is it actually working as intended?
Who typically conducts these internal audits?
The source emphasizes they must be conducted by competent personnel who are, where possible, impartial or objective. This usually means internal auditors need specific training in audit techniques. And ideally, they should not audit their own work or their own department to maintain objectivity.
And the findings go somewhere.
Yes. The results of the internal audits, any nonconformities found, observations, areas for improvement, must be reported to relevant management for action.
The consulting firm example showed how this works in practice, right?
Exactly. They might set up an annual internal audit program, covering all their key processes, maybe auditing client project management more frequently than, say, HR processes. They train a pool of their own staff to be internal auditors, ensuring they rotate assignments so they're not auditing their direct colleagues' work. The audit findings, identifying where procedures aren't being followed or where processes could be more efficient, become a vital input for their regular management review meetings.
Speaking of which, the third major part of Clause 9 is management review. This sounds like the top-level check-in.
It is. This is where top management formally reviews the QMS at planned intervals. The purpose is to ensure the system is still suitable for the organization's purpose, adequate to meet requirements, effective in achieving the planned results, and properly aligned with the overall strategic direction of the business.
So it's a strategic health check for the QMS. What do they actually look at in these reviews?
The standard is quite specific about the required inputs for management review. They need to consider the status of actions from previous management reviews, any changes in internal or external issues relevant to QMS, linking back to Clause 4 context, changes in risks and opportunities, Clause 6, and crucially, information on the QMS's performance and effectiveness.
Performance information like?
Like trends and nonconformities in corrective actions, results from monitoring and measurement, those KPIs we talked about, internal and external audit results, customer satisfaction feedback, supplier performance data. They also look at the adequacy of resources, the effectiveness of actions taken to address risks and opportunities, and any new opportunities for improvement. It's a really comprehensive checkup based on evidence.
And what are the outcomes or outputs of this review?
The output must include decisions and actions. Specifically, decisions related to opportunities for improvement. Any necessary changes needed to the QMS itself, maybe updating policies or objectives, and any resource needs identified, like needing more staff, new equipment, or budget for training.
The transport company example with the CEO and directors holding semi-annual reviews visualizes this perfectly.
Yes. Imagine the CEO and directors sitting down, looking at hard data dashboards, showing performance indicators like accident rates, customer complaints about delays, vehicle maintenance costs, fuel efficiency trends, and recent internal audit findings. Based on that data, they might decide to invest in a new GPS tracking system to improve routing and reduce delays, or implement a targeted driver safety training program to address accident trends. These decisions become formal action plans with assigned owners and deadlines, and their progress is tracked and reviewed at the next management review meeting.
So it creates this continuous cycle of evaluation, top-level decision-making, and action.
Exactly. Clause 9 is the vital feedback loop. It tells you how the system is performing and feeds that information back into the system for action and improvement.
Which leads us beautifully and logically to the final clause, Clause 10, improvement. This feels like the engine that keeps the whole thing moving forward and getting better over time.
Absolutely. That's a great analogy. This clause is all about ensuring the QMS isn't static. It needs to be constantly evolving and improving. It starts with how you handle things when they go wrong, addressing nonconformity, and taking corrective action.
Okay, so if a problem or a nonconformity occurs, maybe identified through monitoring, an audit, or a customer complaint, you react.
Yes, the first step is to react promptly. Take action to control the immediate situation, correct the specific problem as possible, and deal with any immediate consequences. But the really crucial step, the improvement part, is evaluating the need for action to eliminate the cause of the nonconformity.
Ah, so it's not just fixing the symptom, but finding and fixing the root cause.
Exactly. That's the core of corrective action. You need to figure out why the problem happened in the first place to prevent it from recurring.
So root cause analysis tools might come in here.
Precisely. Then you implement the necessary corrective action to address that root cause. And you don't stop there. You need to review the effectiveness of the corrective action taken after some time. Did it actually work? Did the problem stay gone? And finally, you might need to update your risks and opportunities assessment if the nonconformity highlighted something you hadn't previously considered.
The electronics company example the source used showed this in action, right? Finding a recurring defect.
Yes. If they find a recurring issue, like a particular type of faulty solder joint on their circuit boards, they don't just rework the affected boards each time. They launch a formal root cause analysis. Maybe they use a technique like the five whys, asking why repeatedly to drill down past the symptoms. Or perhaps an Ishikawa diagram, a fishbone diagram, to brainstorm potential causes across different categories like materials, methods, machines, people, environment.
And they might find?
They might find the underlying issue is actually poorly calibrated soldering equipment or maybe inadequate operator training on a specific technique. The corrective action then addresses that root cause, recalibrating the machine, providing targeted training. And then they monitor future production, runs closely to verify that the corrective action was effective, and the defect rate for that issue has significantly decreased or disappeared.
That makes sense. It's about lasting fixes. And then there's the broader concept within Clause 10, continual improvement.
Yes, this goes beyond just reacting to problems. Clause 10.3 explicitly requires the organization to continually improve the suitability, adequacy, and effectiveness of its quality management system.
How do you do that? Where do the ideas come from?
You use the outputs from your analysis and evaluation activities, Clause 9.1, and the outputs from your management reviews, Clause 9.3, to actively identify needs and opportunities for improvement, even if there hasn't been a specific nonconformity or problem. It's about proactively seeking ways to enhance performance, efficiency, or customer satisfaction.
This is where you're not just fixing things, but actively trying to make good things even better.
Precisely. The source mentions a manufacturing company that uses the classic PDCA cycle plan, do, check, act, as their fundamental framework for driving continuous improvement initiatives. They might have cross-functional teams that meet regularly, look at process performance data, and brainstorm ways to make incremental improvements, maybe optimizing machine settings for better throughput, streamlining a documentation workflow, or finding ways to reduce energy consumption in a process.
And the source highlighted a key source of these improvement ideas.
Yes, it specifically mentioned that employee suggestions are often a main source for valuable improvement initiatives. This really underscores the idea that continual improvement isn't just a top-down mandate for management. Involving the people who actually do the work every day is crucial. They often have the best insights into where inefficiencies lie or how things could be done better.
That makes total sense. They're on the front lines, seeing the issues and opportunities firsthand. So Clause 10 is really about embedding a culture of learning, problem solving, and constantly striving to get better.
It's the dynamic element. It's what keeps the QMS relevant, alive, and driving the organization towards higher levels of performance over time.
Now, the source spends some dedicated time detailing the process approach, which you mentioned earlier is really fundamental to how ISO 9001 works, especially since the 2000 revision. Can we unpack that a bit more?
Yes, absolutely. This is one of the core quality management principles that the standard is built upon. Instead of viewing an organization as just a collection of separate departments or functions working in silos, the process approach encourages you to see it as a system of interconnected processes.
Processes that do what?
Processes that transform inputs into outputs, ultimately delivering value to the customer. Think about order fulfillment it cuts across sales, maybe inventory, production, shipping, billing. It's a process, not just one department's job.
Okay, so how do you actually apply this process approach in practice?
Well, it starts with process identification. Every significant activity or series of activities within the organization needs to be clearly defined as a process. For each process, you need to identify its inputs. What triggers it? What resources does it use? Its intended outputs? What does it produce? Who is responsible for the process? The process owner. What resources are needed? People, equipment, information, and crucially, how it interacts with other processes. Where does it get its inputs from, and where do its outputs go?
So mapping it all out.
Essentially, yes. The source says mapping out these key processes and their interactions is fundamental to understanding how all the different activities fit together and contribute to the final result for the customer.
And for each of these identified processes, you need to measure how well it's doing.
Exactly. Performance measurement is key. You need to define measurable key performance indicators, KPIs, for each important process to allow you to evaluate its effectiveness. Is it achieving the desired results? And its efficiency? Is it doing so with optimal use of resources?
And you watch these KPIs over time.
Yes, continuous monitoring of those process KPIs is what allows you to spot issues or opportunities for improvement in a timely manner. If a KPI for a critical process starts trending in the wrong direction, you know exactly where to focus your improvement efforts.
And the idea of process ownership, you mentioned that.
Crucial. Assigning a clear process owner for each key process is vital. This person is accountable for the overall performance and conformity of that specific process. They are the ones who typically coordinate improvement activities related to their process and ensure it stays aligned with the broader organizational objectives.
What's a big overall benefit of looking at the organization through this process lens?
The source really notes it helps break down those traditional functional silos we talked about. Instead of people just worrying about what happens within their own department, they start to see how their work flows into the next step and how it ultimately impacts the customer downstream. It fosters collaboration across departments and keeps the focus squarely on creating end-to-end value for the customer.
The hospital example the source used, mapping the patient admission process, really illustrates this well, doesn't it?
It does. That single process, getting a patient admitted, clearly involves multiple departments: reception, nursing staff, doctors, maybe the lab, maybe pharmacy, billing. The list goes on. Mapping it as a single process can reveal bottlenecks, delays, or communication breakdowns that occur between those departments, things that a purely functional view might completely miss.
And the process owner drives improvement across those functions.
Exactly. The designated process owner for patient admission would work across those departmental lines using KPIs like average wait time from arrival to being roomed or patient satisfaction score with the admission experience to identify issues and drive improvements for the entire patient journey through that process, regardless of which department is involved at each step.
That makes it feel much more integrated and genuinely customer-focused. A powerful shift in perspective.
It really is. When applied well, it's a very powerful way to manage and improve an organization.
Another key element you mentioned, especially prominent in the 2015 revision, is risk-based thinking. Let's unpack that concept a bit more. You said it's woven throughout the standard.
Yes, that's right. While Clause 6 on planning explicitly requires addressing risks and opportunities, the principle of risk-based thinking is meant to be applied implicitly throughout the entire QMS. It was perhaps the single most significant conceptual shift in the 2015 version.
And the core idea is?
It encourages a fundamentally preventative approach to quality management. Instead of just reacting to problems, you're proactively thinking about potential risks and also potential opportunities in all your activities and processes related to quality.
So it forces you to think ahead constantly.
Absolutely. It generally involves a few steps. First, risk identification, systematically thinking about and identifying potential events, situations, or uncertainties that could negatively impact your ability to achieve your quality objectives or affect the conformity of your product services or impact customer satisfaction. This needs to happen across all relevant QMS processes.
And once you've brainstormed a list of potential risks, you evaluate them.
Yes. Risk evaluation or analysis. You analyze the identified risks, usually considering two key dimensions: their probability or likelihood, how likely is this risk to actually occur, and their potential impact or severity. If it does occur, how bad would the consequences be? This analysis helps you prioritize which risks are the most significant and warrant attention.
You focus on the big ones, and then you decide what to do about those high priority risks.
That's risk treatment. Based on the evaluation, you define and implement appropriate actions or controls to mitigate those significant risks. This could involve putting new controls in place to reduce the likelihood or impact, changing a process entirely to avoid the risk, maybe transferring the risk, like through insurance, or in some cases, consciously deciding to accept a certain level of residual risk if the cost or effort of further mitigation outweighs the potential benefit.
And it's not a one-time thing.
Definitely not. The final step is ongoing monitoring and review. You need to continuously monitor the risks you've identified and, critically, the effectiveness of the treatment actions or controls you've implemented. The risk landscape can change, new risks emerge, old ones become less relevant, and your controls might not be as effective as you initially thought. So you need to regularly review and update your risk assessments and treatment plans.
The food company example with the contamination risk seems like a perfect illustration of this whole cycle.
It really is. Identifying contamination as a major risk. Identification. Analyzing how likely it is given their current processes and how severe a widespread contamination event would be for consumers and the brand. Evaluation. Implementing specific controls at critical points of production, like enhanced sanitation procedures, strict allergen segregation protocols, regular environmental monitoring swabs, treatment, and then regularly auditing adherence to those procedures, analyzing the results of the environmental swabs, and scanning for emerging food safety risks to ensure the controls remain effective and relevant. Monitoring and review.
You can really see how this proactive approach saves you from dealing with a potential crisis product. Recalls reputation damage later on.
Exactly. The source really stresses that embedding this risk-based thinking throughout the QMS helps prevent problems that could not only harm customers, but also severely damage the company's bottom line and public image. It shifts quality management from detection to prevention.
Okay, we've gone through the structure and key concepts. Let's talk about the payoff. What are the really tangible benefits of going through the process and getting ISO 9001 certification? We've touched on examples, but let's try to summarize the big wins, the source highlights.
Right. This is where the rubber really meets the road in terms of demonstrating value. The source provides some pretty compelling data and examples of the real-world advantages. It groups them into a couple of categories. First, let's talk about competitive benefits.
Like just being fundamentally better at what you do. Is that part of it?
Precisely. Improved performance is a big one. Implementing a structured QMS forces you to standardize processes, monitor them systematically, and use data to drive improvement. This naturally leads to greater operational efficiency, reduction in waste, think fewer defects, less scrap, less rework, and ultimately more consistently high quality in your products or services.
And the source put numbers on that.
It did. It quotes data suggesting that certified companies report average productivity increases in the range of 15 to 20%. That's a pretty significant jump.
Wow, 15, 20% productivity boost just from managing quality more systematically. That's actually quite surprising.
It really shows the power of standardization, measurement, and data-driven improvement when applied consistently. This internal improvement also naturally leads to increased customer satisfaction. An effective QMS ensures you're delivering consistently, reliably, and are more responsive to customer needs and complaints when they do arise.
Happier customers.
Happier customers who stick around. The source cites data indicating certified organizations report an average reduction in customer complaints of 25 to 30% and an increase in customer loyalty of around 20%.
Those are tangible numbers. And ultimately, does this translate into a competitive advantage in the marketplace?
Definitely. Being certified sends a clear signal to potential customers, partners, and even competitors that you are serious about quality and have a robust, internationally recognized system in place to manage it. The source says that around 80% of certified companies report an improvement in their market image and reputation as a result. It clearly differentiates you from competitors who aren't certified.
This is where those case studies you mentioned earlier become really powerful evidence, isn't it?
Absolutely. Think back to the metalworking SME. They saw internal improvements. Yes, defects dropped 35%, delivery delays fell 40%, but the real strategic win for them. Their revenue jumped 25% within 2 years, specifically because they could now access new customers who required ISO 901 certification as a condition of doing business.
So it wasn't just about internal efficiency. It literally opened up new markets for them.
Exactly. Or the private clinic example. They reduced patient waiting times and documentation errors, which boosted patient satisfaction by a huge 45%. But the game changer was that the certification helped them gain accreditation with the National Health System, which massively expanded their potential patient base and enhanced their credibility.
Again, market access and growth.
And the IT service company. By using the QMS to improve their support processes and customer focus, they slashed ticket resolution times by half, saw an incredible 80% increase in client loyalty metrics. And the big win, they won a major public tender, largely thanks to having the certification, which doubled their revenue in 3 years. The source presents these not as rare exceptions, but as typical outcomes when the standard is implemented well.
These are really tangible bottom-line impacts across different sectors. Beyond the competitive side, the source also talks about clear economic benefits, too.
Yes. Direct cost reduction is often a major driver and outcome. Significant savings can come from having fewer rejects, less need for a costly rework, fewer customer complaints, which consume time and resources to resolve, and those overall operational efficiency gains we already mentioned. The source indicates that certified organizations typically report average operational cost savings in the region of 10 to 15%.
That's not insignificant. And increased revenue potential, as we just saw clearly in those case studies.
Exactly. Revenue growth comes from multiple angles. Yeah. Attracting new clients, especially those in supply chains or sectors where certification is mandated or preferred. Increasing sales to existing customers due to higher loyalty and satisfaction. And sometimes, like in that public tender example, qualifying for significant contracts or business opportunities that you simply couldn't have bid on otherwise.
That example the source gave of the medium-sized manufacturing company calculating their ROI, that figure was almost hard to believe.
It's a very powerful illustration from the source showing the potential financial upside. They calculated an initial investment of around 20,000 euro DSTRI to implement the system and get certified. That might sound like a substantial upfront cost, but the key finding was that they recouped that entire investment in just 8 months. Purely through the documented savings from reduced production waste and improved operational efficiency.
8 months payback.
Just 8 months. And going further, the source calculates they achieved an incredible 250% return on investment in the very first year after achieving certification.
Wow. That really flips the script, doesn't it? It turns the common perception of ISO 9001 being just a necessary cost or administrative burden into potentially a massive strategic investment with remarkably rapid returns.
It really does. The source makes a very strong case that when implemented properly, with a focus on real improvement rather than just compliance, the financial benefits are very real and can be quite substantial.
And speaking of opening doors, the source specifically highlights how ISO 9001 certification facilitates strategic partnerships. How does that work?
This is a huge factor, especially for smaller or medium-sized companies looking to work with larger corporations or enter more regulated or demanding markets. Certification is very often a fundamental requirement in supplier qualification processes.
Particularly in certain high-stakes sectors.
Yes. The source specifically mentions industries like automotive, aerospace, medical devices, and even public administration services. Many large players in these fields maintain approved supplier lists, and having ISO 9001 certification is frequently a non-negotiable prerequisite just to get onto that list.
That electronic components producer example you mentioned earlier shows this barrier to entry very clearly.
Precisely. That company literally could not even be considered as a supplier to a major automotive group until they obtained their ISO 9001 certificate. It's effectively the price of admission required to participate in certain sophisticated supply chains.
And it plays a role in public tenders, too.
Absolutely. The source notes that ISO 9001 certification frequently gives bidding companies preferential points in the evaluation process for public procurement contracts, both at national and international levels. In some cases, it might even be a mandatory requirement to even submit a bid.
Like the construction company winning that $2 million tender, partly because of the bonus points they got for being certified.
Exactly. That's a direct example of how certification provided a tangible, competitive edge in winning significant government or large-scale private sector contracts. It demonstrates a level of organizational maturity, process control, and reliability that procurement bodies value highly.
It's a signal of trustworthiness, in a way.
It is. And beyond supplier relationships and tenders, it also facilitates things like joint ventures and collaborations. When two or more companies that are both ISO 9001 certified decide to partner up, say on a joint R&D project or a complex service delivery, they already share a common language and framework for managing processes and quality. This makes integrating their systems and working together much smoother and more effective right from the start.
That example of the Italian and German companies collaborating on developing a new product.
Right. According to the source, that collaboration was made significantly easier and faster because both companies were already operating under the ISO 9001 standard. They understood each other's process-oriented approach, documentation practices, and quality controls, which simplified the task of integrating their respective activities and responsibilities for the joint venture.
So certification isn't just about getting your own house in order. It's also about making you a more reliable, understandable, and attractive partner within the broader business ecosystem.
It really builds trust and interoperability, which are absolutely essential in today's increasingly interconnected and collaborative business world.
The standard also seems designed to play nicely with other management systems. The source talks about integration with other management systems. How does that work?
This is becoming increasingly important as more and more companies recognize the need to manage not just quality, but also environmental impact, occupational health and safety, information security, and so on. ISO has made this much easier by developing a common framework called the high-level structure, often abbreviated as HLS.
A common structure for different standards.
Exactly. All new and revised ISO management system standards now follow this same 10-clause structure. They use the same core text for common requirements and share common terms and definitions.
And the benefit of that is easier integration.
Significantly easier, yes. It greatly facilitates implementing ISO 9001 alongside or fully integrating it with other popular management system standards like ISO 14001 for environmental management, ISO 45001 for occupational health and safety, ISO 27001 for information security, or even ISO 22000 for food safety management. They all share the same basic skeleton, the same clause headings and sequence, so you're not starting from scratch or dealing with conflicting structures for each one.
What are the practical benefits for a company of having an integrated management system, maybe covering quality, environment, and safety together?
The source points to some big potential efficiency gains. Firstly, you can reduce redundant documentation. Instead of having three separate manuals, three sets of procedures for common things like document control or internal audits, you might have one integrated manual and shared procedures. Secondly, you can often reduce redundant audits. Accredited certification bodies can frequently conduct integrated audits covering multiple standards simultaneously, which saves significant time, effort, and cost compared to separate audits for each standard.
Streamlining the audit process.
Yes. And perhaps most importantly, you create synergies by managing interrelated processes more efficiently and holistically. For example, when you evaluate a potential new supplier, an integrated approach allows you to consider their quality of performance, their environmental impact, and their health and safety practices all at the same time, using a single evaluation process rather than three separate ones.
That construction company example from the source, the one that integrated quality, environment, and safety, sounds like they saw some major benefits from doing that.
They really did. By implementing an integrated system based on ISO 9001, 14001, and 45001, the source reports they achieved a 30% reduction in the overall volume of their system documentation compared to what they would have needed for three separate systems. They also saw a 40% reduction in their external audit costs due to combined audits. And they reported more efficient management of those interrelated processes, like the supplier evaluation example, which now considers all three aspects simultaneously. It leads to a much more holistic, less fragmented, and ultimately more efficient way to manage these different but often overlapping aspects of organizational responsibility.
That streamlining effect is definitely appealing. You can see why companies would go for that. Okay, so for an organization listening that is now thinking, right, these benefits sound good, I'm interested. What's the certification process actually like? How do you get there?
Right. The source breaks it down into a few key stages. It's definitely a journey, as you said, not an overnight event.
Where does it typically start? Understanding where you are now.
Exactly. It usually begins with a gap analysis. This is an initial evaluation where you systematically compare your organization's current processes, practices, and existing documentation against the specific requirements laid out in the ISO 9001.2015 standard.
What's the point of that?
To identify the gaps. What are you already doing that meets the standard? What are you missing? What needs to be improved, formalized, or documented to comply? It gives you a clear picture of the work ahead.
Okay, so you know the gaps. Then you start building the system to fill them.
Pretty much. The next phase is developing the necessary documented information. This includes creating or updating your quality policy, defining and documenting key procedures, how you perform critical processes, maybe creating detailed operating instructions or work guides for specific tasks, and designing the forms and records you'll need to provide objective evidence that the system is operating as planned.
And as we discussed, the 2015 version gives you flexibility on how much documentation, right?
Exactly. You focus on what's necessary for your QMS to be effective, considering your size, complexity, and people's competence. But you still need to document what the standard requires and what you determine is needed.
Okay, documentation is developed, and then you have to actually put it into action.
Right. Implementation. This is where the documented system becomes your daily reality. It involves rolling out the new or updated processes and procedures across the defined scope of your organization. Critically, it also involves training your personnel, making sure everyone understands the system, their roles within it, and how to follow the new procedures or use the new tools. This implementation phase is often the longest and requires significant effort and change management.
And before you call in the external auditors, you need to check yourselves first.
Absolutely critical step. You need to conduct a full internal audit of your newly implemented or revised QMS. This is your chance to act like the external auditor yourself. Go through all the clauses, check if processes are being followed, review records, identify any non-conformities or areas where the system isn't working as intended. It allows you to find and fix issues before the official certification audit.
Like a dress rehearsal.
Exactly. A very important dress rehearsal. It ensures the system conforms to the standard and, just as importantly, is being effectively implemented and maintained internally.
Okay. Internal audit passed.
Oh.
Then comes the main event, the external certification audit.
Yes. This is conducted by an independent, accredited third-party certification body you choose one you want to work with. The certification audit itself usually happens in two distinct stages.
Stage one and stage two.
Correct. Stage one is often primarily a documentation review. The external auditors will assess your QMS documentation, like your quality manual, key procedures, scope definition, to check if, on paper, your system design appears to meet the requirements of the ISO 9001 standard. They might also do a readiness review on site.
And if stage one looks good,
then you proceed to stage two. This is the main, typically on-site audit. The auditors will spend time visiting your facilities, observing your processes in action, interviewing personnel at various levels, and reviewing records and other evidence to verify that the QMS is not just documented, but is actually implemented effectively and consistently in practice across the organization.
They're checking if you walk the talk.
Precisely. And if you successfully pass that stage 2 audit, meaning they don't find any major nonconformities, then the certificate is released. The certification body issues your official ISO 9001.201 appliance certificate. You are officially certified.
Congratulations. What kind of timeline are we typically talking about for this whole process, from gap analysis to getting the certificate?
The source suggests it typically takes somewhere between 6 and 12 months, but that can vary quite a bit. It really depends on factors like the size and complexity of the organization, how mature its existing processes and systems already are, how big the gap is, and crucially, how much dedicated resource time, people, budget the organization can allocate to the implementation project.
And across that whole journey, is there one single factor that the source highlights as being most important for success?
Yes. The source is very clear and emphatic on this point. Top management involvement and commitment, coupled with the genuine engagement of all personnel, are absolutely crucial for success.
Why is that so critical?
Because if leadership isn't visibly championing the initiative, providing resources, and holding people accountable, and if employees don't understand the why behind it or don't buy into the changes, the QMS will likely just become a bureaucratic exercise. It'll be seen as paperwork, not a tool for improvement. Real success comes when the principles and practices of the QMS become truly integrated into the company culture, the way we do things around here.
It really has to live and breathe within the organization, not just sit in a manual. Which brings us neatly to the topic of maintenance of certification. You don't just get the certificate and then you're done forever.
Exactly right. Certification isn't a one-time achievement. It's an ongoing commitment to maintaining and improving your QMS. The ISO 9001 certificate itself is typically valid for 3 years.
Okay, 3 years, and what happens during those 3 years?
To ensure you're maintaining the system, the certification body will conduct periodic surveillance audits. These are usually carried out annually, though the frequency can sometimes vary.
Are they as intense as the initial certification audit?
Generally, no. Surveillance audits are typically shorter and less comprehensive than the initial stage 2 audit. They usually focus on verifying continued conformity, checking the key processes are still being followed, looking at how nonconformities and corrective actions are being handled, reviewing internal audit results and management reviews, and confirming that the QMS is being effectively maintained.
Okay, so annual checkups, and then what happens at the end of the 3-year cycle?
At the end of the 3 years, before your certificate expires, you undergo a renewal audit, sometimes called a recertification audit. This is another more in-depth audit, similar in scope to the initial stage 2 audit, designed to assess the performance and conformity of the entire QMS again before the certification body will renew your certificate for another 3-year period.
What's the key trap that organizations sometimes fall into with this ongoing cycle?
The source specifically warns against the common certify and forget trap. This is where an organization puts in a huge effort to get the initial certification, maybe sees it primarily as a marketing badge or a customer requirement, and then lets the system stagnate. They stop doing regular internal audits properly, management reviews become rushed formalities, documentation doesn't get updated, and the focus on continuous improvement fades.
And the consequence.
The QMS stops providing real value internally, and eventually they risk failing a surveillance audit or losing their certification altogether at the renewal audit because the system is no longer effective or conforming.
That service company example the source mentioned, the one that had maintained its certification for over a decade, they clearly avoided that trap.
They absolutely did. The source highlighted that they didn't just view the surveillance and renewal audits as hurdles to overcome. Instead, they actively used them as opportunities. Opportunities to get external feedback, to identify new areas for focus and improvement each year, and to ensure their QMS was continually updated and adapted to keep pace with market changes, technology evolution, and customer expectations. They saw it as a way to keep benefiting from their initial investment continuously.
So ongoing maintenance isn't just about keeping the certificate on the wall. It's really about ensuring the QMS delivers sustained effectiveness and continuous benefit over the long term.
Precisely. It keeps the system alive and working for the organization.
Let's circle back to the people aspect again, because it seems so critical. Clause 7 talked about competence, but the source also dedicates focus specifically to personnel competence and training.
Yes, absolutely vital. The source strongly emphasizes a core principle. Quality isn't just the responsibility of a dedicated quality department. Achieving quality objectives and ensuring the effectiveness of the QMS relies on the contribution of everyone in the organization. Every single employee plays a role, whether directly or indirectly, in contributing to customer satisfaction and meeting organizational goals.
So if everyone's involved, does training need to be tailored to different roles? You can't just give everyone the same generic quality presentation, can you?
Exactly. The source stresses that training programs must be differentiated based on the specific roles and responsibilities that personnel have within the QMS and in their daily work.
Can you give examples of different levels or types of training?
Sure. The source suggests you might have basic quality awareness training for absolutely all staff, covering the quality policy, the importance of customer focus, and their general role in the QMS. Then, more specific process training for operators or service providers who execute core operational tasks, teaching them the correct procedures, quality standards, and how to use specific equipment or tools properly. Managers and supervisors might need more advanced training on quality management tools and techniques, like statistical process control, root cause analysis methods, risk assessment, and how to lead improvement teams. And personnel who will be conducting internal audits require specialized training on auditing principles, procedures, techniques, and reporting.
So a multi-layered approach. And critically, you need to check if the training actually worked, right? Not just track attendance.
Absolutely crucial point, and one that's often overlooked. Pause 7 requires competence, and training is a way to achieve it. But you must evaluate the effectiveness of the training actions taken. Did people just sit through the session, or did they actually gain the required knowledge and skills? And even more importantly, does that acquired learning translate into concrete changes in behavior and improved results back on the job?
How can you check that?
You can use various methods: post-training tests or assessments, practical demonstrations of skills, on-the-job observation by supervisors, or tracking relevant performance indicators like error rates, procedure adherence metrics, before and after the training to see if there's a measurable impact.
That manufacturing company example the source used with the 3-level training program sounds like a very comprehensive and effective approach.
It really does. They provided basic quality orientation for all 200 employees. They delivered specific hands-on process training for the 150 production operators. They gave the 15 function managers more advanced training on quality tools and leadership. And they also formally qualified 10 employees as internal auditors through dedicated training.
And they measured the impact.
Yes. The source reports they measured effectiveness not just through learning tests immediately after training, but also by observing work practices later. They documented a 40% improvement in the correct application of standard operating procedures on the factory floor, which directly correlated with a measurable reduction in production nonconformities.
That's a really clear demonstration of the link between investing in targeted training and seeing tangible quality improvements.
It absolutely shows that empowering employees with the right knowledge and skills isn't just a nice to have. It's a direct investment in the effectiveness of your QMS and your overall operational performance.
Let's talk about documented information again, specifically addressing that lingering stereotype or fear of excessive paperwork associated with ISO standards.
Right. It's a common misconception that needs addressing. As we touched on when discussing Clause 7, the 2015 version of ISO 9001 made significant strides in moving away from prescriptive documentation requirements.
How significant?
It substantially reduced the specific list of mandatory documents and records that were required by previous versions of the standard. There used to be 6 mandatory procedures, for example. Those specific mandates are gone.
So organizations genuinely have more flexibility now in what they need to write down.
Much more, yes. The standard now requires organizations to determine for themselves the documented information that they deem necessary for the effectiveness of their specific quality management system.
Based on what factors?
Based on factors like the size and type of the organization, the complexity of its processes and interactions, the criticality of those processes, the risks and opportunities involved, and importantly, the competence of its personnel. A small organization with highly experienced staff working on simple processes might naturally require much less detailed documented information than a large, complex organization with high staff turnover operating in a highly regulated environment.
So less documentation isn't the goal, but appropriate documentation is.
Exactly. The goal is documentation that adds value, supports consistency, provides necessary evidence, and helps people do their jobs correctly and effectively, not documentation for documentation's sake.
What are the typical types of documented information that organizations still commonly maintain, even with this flexibility?
The source mentions the common types you'd expect to find in most QMS implementations. You still need your documented quality policy. Many organizations still choose to have a quality manual, even though it's no longer mandatory, as a high-level overview of their QMS and how it meets the standards clauses. Then you have procedures, documented ways of carrying out key processes. You might have more detailed operating instructions or work instructions, step-by-step guides for specific tasks within a process. And critically, you need records, documented evidence that activities were performed and results were achieved, like inspection reports, calibration certificates, training completion forms, customer feedback logs, audit findings.
And the trend now, particularly with procedures and instructions, is definitely towards digital rather than paper.
Absolutely. The move towards using digital document management systems, whether sophisticated, dedicated software or simpler solutions, using shared drives or company intranets, is a major and ongoing trend. And for very good reasons.
What are the main benefits of going digital with QMS documentation?
The source highlights numerous benefits. Much easier and faster access to the right information for everyone who needs it, wherever they are. Robust version control, which is critical, ensuring everyone is always working from the latest approved version of a procedure or drawing, preventing costly errors caused by using outdated information. Streamlined processes for reviewing, approving, and distributing documents. Easier sharing and collaboration on documents. And of course, significant potential cost savings on printing, physical storage space, and the time wasted searching for paper documents or managing physical archives.
That medium-sized company example the source gave, implementing an intranet-based system, sounds very relatable and shows clear benefits.
It is. By moving their procedures, work instructions, and forms onto a company intranet with defined access levels based on roles, they drastically cut down the time employees spent searching for documents. The source quoted a 70% reduction. They ensured everyone automatically had access to the latest versions, eliminating confusion and errors. And they significantly cut their costs associated with printing, distributing, and archiving paper documents. It's just a much more modern, efficient, and effective approach that aligns perfectly with the overall efficiency goals of a QMS.
Makes sense. Efficiency in managing the documentation itself supports the overall efficiency of the QMS. Now, ISO standards themselves aren't static. They evolve over time, right? Let's talk briefly about the transition and updates of the standard.
Yes, that's an important point. ISO has a policy of regularly reviewing its standards, typically every 5 years or so, to ensure they remain current, relevant, and reflect the latest best practices and changes in the business environment. ISO 9001 has certainly evolved significantly over its history since it was first published.
Can you give a sense of that evolution, like the early days?
Sure. The source mentions that the very first edition, back in 1987, was quite heavily focused on quality control and inspection checking quality at the end of the line. Essentially, the 2000 revision marked a major paradigm shift by fully embracing and structuring the standard around the process approach that we discussed earlier.
A big change. And the 2015 version, the one we're focusing on, brought in some big changes too, didn't it?
Definitely. As we've highlighted throughout our discussion, the key changes introduced in the 2015 version included the much stronger emphasis on understanding the organization's context, Clause 4, the explicit requirement for risk-based thinking to be embedded throughout the QMS, permeating multiple clauses, and a significantly greater focus on the role and commitment of top leadership, Clause 5.
And you mentioned there's talk of another new revision potentially on the horizon.
Yes. The source notes that the next revision of ISO 9001 is currently anticipated sometime around 2025, though timelines can shift. Based on current trends and discussions, it's expected that this next revision might place greater emphasis on integrating aspects like organizational resilience, change management, knowledge management, and potentially incorporating elements related to sustainability and the impact of digitalization on quality management.
So for organizations that currently hold ISO 9001.2015 certification, they need to be prepared to transition when a new version is eventually released.
They absolutely do. When a new version of the standard is published, ISO typically provides a defined transition period. Historically, this has often been 3 years. Organizations holding certification to the older version must successfully transition their QMS to meet the requirements of the new version and undergo a transition audit within that time frame to maintain their certification status.
Is it generally better to start planning for that transition early rather than waiting until the deadline looms?
The source strongly recommends a proactive approach. As soon as a new version is released, or even when drafts become available, organizations should start by conducting a gap analysis to understand the differences and the specific changes required for their QMS. Then they can develop a transition plan and implement the necessary changes thoughtfully over time.
What's the benefit of starting early?
It allows organizations to leverage the new requirements not just as a compliance exercise, but as genuine opportunities for further improvement. You can integrate the changes strategically rather than just scrambling at the last minute to update documents and tick boxes purely to meet the formal transition deadline.
It keeps the focus on continuous improvement even when the standard itself is the thing that's changing and driving that improvement.
Exactly. It integrates the standard's own evolution into the organization's ongoing cycle of improvement, ensuring the QMS stays relevant and continues to add value.
We've woven them in throughout our conversation, but the source briefly revisits those success case studies again near the end. Why bring them up again?
I think it's really just to reinforce the main message with concrete evidence one last time. Recapping the experiences of the metalworking SME, the private clinic, and the IT service company serves as powerful, tangible proof across very different sectors of the very real, measurable benefits that we've been discussing throughout. Benefits like reduced defects and costs, increased efficiency, significantly improved customer satisfaction, enhanced market reputation, and substantial revenue growth.
It drives home the point that these aren't just theoretical possibilities.
Precisely. They are achievable outcomes. And the source reiterates one final time what it sees as the common ingredient, the key factor that underpinned the success in all of these diverse case studies.
Which was?
Strong, visible commitment from top management, coupled with the effort to genuinely integrate the principles and practices of the QMS into the everyday company culture, making quality management the way we do business around here, not just a separate system or function run by the quality department.
That really seems to be the consistent thread connecting effective implementation to actually achieving those tangible, significant results. Okay, so wrapping things up. For anyone listening, maybe a business owner or manager, maybe someone working in quality, or even just someone curious about improving how things work, what are the suggested next steps and conclusion points from the source if they're seriously interested in exploring ISO 9001-1 for their organization?
Right. The source offers some clear, practical advice on how to get started. First step, conduct a preliminary analysis. Do that gap analysis we talked about, comparing your current state against the ISO 9001.201 FIM requirements. This will give you a realistic understanding of where you stand today and the scope of the effort involved.
Understand the journey ahead before you commit.
Yes. Then, based on that analysis, develop a detailed implementation plan. This plan should outline the specific steps needed to close the identified gaps, assign clear responsibilities for different actions, allocate the necessary resources, time, people, budget, and set realistic timelines for completion.
And don't forget the people aspect during implementation.
Absolutely not. The source emphasizes prioritizing training and awareness programs right from the start. You need to educate all relevant personnel on basic quality principles, the specifics of your planned QMS, why it's being implemented, and critically, what their individual role and contribution will be. Ensure they understand the why and the how.
And finally, should organizations consider getting outside help?
The source suggests considering the use of specialized consulting. Experienced external consultants can bring valuable expertise, practical experience from other implementations, and knowledge of best practices to help guide you through the process more efficiently and effectively. They can help you avoid common pitfalls and tailor the system appropriately to your specific needs, potentially making the journey smoother and ensuring you build a system that truly adds value.
Okay. So, summing it all up then, what's the core takeaway message from the source about ISO 9001 certification? Is it worth the effort?
The source positions it very clearly. ISO 9001 certification should be viewed as a strategic investment, not merely an expense or a compliance burden. It's a framework designed for any organization, regardless of size or sector, that is genuinely serious about achieving operational excellence, consistently meeting customer needs, and driving higher levels of customer satisfaction and loyalty.
And the real value isn't just getting the certificate itself, the piece of paper.
Far from it. That's just the external validation. The true lasting value, according to the source, comes from deeply embracing and internalizing the underlying principles of the standard, adopting that systematic, process-oriented, fact-based, risk-based approach to managing quality in everything you do. It's about integrating these principles into the very fabric, the culture of the organization. The companies that successfully do that are the ones who unlock the full potential of the standard and reap the biggest, most sustainable rewards in the long run.
It really sounds like it's about building a solid foundation for sustained success and continuous improvement.
It really is. It provides a robust framework for organizational discipline, data-driven decision-making, continuous learning, and ultimately enhanced reliability and performance.
Well, this has been an incredibly thorough and insightful deep dive into the world of ISO 9001.2015. Thank you so much for navigating us through the source material and making sense of what can seem like a complex topic.
My pleasure entirely. It really is a powerful tool when it's understood and applied strategically, not just mechanically.
And to you, our listener, thank you for joining us on this exploration today. As you go about your day, maybe here's a little thought to ponder, sparked by our discussion. How could you apply some of these core principles of systematic thinking, of continuous improvement, maybe just in a small way, in your own life or your own work?
Interesting challenge.
Yeah, maybe pick just one small process you do regularly. It could be anything. Think about its context. Think about what could go wrong. That's risk. Or what could go really right if you change something. That's opportunity. And then maybe think about how you could actually measure if you're doing it effectively.
It's surprising how applicable those core ideas, context, risk, measurement, improvement, really are, isn't it? Almost anywhere.
Indeed it is. Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep with us.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.